Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We talk automotive maintenance and repair this afternoon with Gordon Fricke, owner and operator of Barber & Fricke Automotive Incorporated, an independent repair, auto body, towing, and used car facility in Hoosick, New York. Gordon has been in the game for a long time, going back to a training school in Wolfsburg, Germany back in 1979. Always entertaining, always informative, always good to have him here. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. If you have a car question, 1-800-348-2551. Now, you can also check in via social media, and here's how you can do it. You can post your comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website. You just navigate to wamc.org/voxpop, or you can tweet us with your questions at WAMC Vox Pop, one word, WAMC Vox Pop, or go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Of course, we always welcome calls. That's nice, too. 1-800-348-2551. Gordon, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you. Very good. How about you?
Not too bad. Now, we have calls already on the line, but I have one question. Two. What's a transmission, and why does it cost so much to fix?
Well, a transmission, kind of what the name implies, transmits or transfers power from the engine,
yeah,
the turning of the engine's crankshaft, and it has to change the speed of that engine's crankshaft and direct the power out to the wheels to propel the vehicle.
Yeah.
So it needs to do it in a bunch of different ranges, at different gear speeds. And in the olden days, they were manual transmissions, real gears that you shifted yourself,
yeah,
with a clutch and a lever. And then automatic transmissions came out where there are still metal gears in there, but they are shifted automatically, hydraulically. And now there's transmissions that are seamless. You don't feel any shifts. They're called constant variable transmissions.
That must be very expensive to fix.
Well, yes, they are. And the early ones were problematic because they hadn't had the bugs ironed out. And a lot of car manufacturers got into them and very quickly got out.
Hmm.
But they're getting better. They're still out there.
Okay, so a manual transmission, which is what I grew up with for at least a long portion of time, they're cheaper to fix?
Well, they can be, yes. And for the most part, they are longer lasting. Because in an automatic, there are so many moving parts,
yeah,
so many things that have to take place to get these shifts at the right times, upshifts, downshifts, torque converter lock up for efficiency. You've got hydraulic fluid in there, transmission fluid. You got the computer involved. So to answer your question, yeah, the manuals are simpler, generally more durable, and don't create much trouble.
Okay, well, that solves my question. Let's get to the phones at 1-800-348-2551. Pat in Lanesboro. Pat, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Hi, I've got a 2001 Toyota Camry, and I had one of those oil change shops change my oil, and they did not put the oil filter on tight enough. And over the course of about 350 miles, they hemorrhaged out all of my oil and smelled something that couldn't explain. Eventually pulled over, checked it, saw that my engine was, there's only just a hint of oil on the very end of the dipstick, if my car was pointing nose down, like on an incline, which it was. And anyway, there were no indicator lights, no warning lights, no overheating that came on. But after that, my engine sounds a little different, and my fuel economy, and I know my fuel economy down to a tenth of a mile, and instead of having typically 33 miles per gallon highway, I'm now getting somewhere in the range of 22 to 24 miles per gallon on the highway, and it's abysmal in the city in the winter. I've gotten as little as 11 miles per gallon, and I'm a very, very conservative driver. No jackrabbit starts. Not quite a hypermiler, but leaning that way. And so I'm wondering, what should I have checked to figure out why my fuel economy has changed, and how much is it going to cost me?
Okay.
And I've also got a follow-up question.
Okay. How many miles are on the car now?
Right now, it's about 163,000.
And how many were on it when it was low on oil?
It was probably about 125,000.
Okay.
130,000, maybe.
Now, when you were when the oil leak developed, you said no warning lights came on, no buzzers, no gauges. So you really didn't
nothing.
You didn't run out of oil. What caused?
Well, I don't know how valid this is, but I was on one of the Toyota forums. It was claimed that the Camry has an oversight in the way that Generation 4 was designed, that it doesn't. There's something about either the oil pressure sensor is basically non-functional or non-existent.
Well, how did you discover it? Did you see the leak? Did you pull the dipstick one day just to see how your oil level was?
What it was is 2 days after the oil change, I was driving up to Toronto, and I kept smelling oil. And I thought some oil had just spilled onto the engine case, didn't think too much of it. But after driving all the way to Toronto and driving partway back home, I thought, this is a little strange. I pulled over, checked the dipstick, and that's when I discovered there was no oil left.
How much oil did it take to bring it back to the normal level?
If this Canadian garage can be trusted, they claim they put the equivalent of 4 liters in.
4 liters, okay.
Which would be pretty much everything.
That's quite a bit.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. If it did get that low and it did do some damage, and the damage would occur to the engine bearings and maybe some slight scoring of the cylinder walls.
I did have the compression checked, and they claimed it's fine.
Yeah, yeah, and it very well could be. It's possible that the engine suffered some premature wear from that event. I'm very surprised that the oil light didn't come on. I assume the oil light does work. When you turn the key on, that light comes on as an indicator?
Yes, it does come on. Yeah. There's a little lamp. It looks like a little genie's lamp.
Yeah. I don't know if that's going to contribute to that drastic of a loss of fuel economy. I would look more towards things like filter condition, spark plug condition.
Oh, it changed everything.
You did, yeah.
Yep.
Catalytic converters can very, very slowly and gradually decrease their ability to flow. Not enough for you to notice anything, but...
So if I had a bad exhaust system, that could affect
fuel economy? Well, it's possible. If your catalytic converter was starting to plug slightly, you would inherently... You'd be giving it more... You'd be stepping on it harder to go where you wanted to go, and you might use a little more gas because the power has been decreased. But I don't think that event drastically had that much of an effect on your economy. I think it's probably a combination of a lot of things. Age of the car, mileage, things like that.
Well, my girlfriend at the time, who didn't know anything about cars, had never owned one, even she could tell that the engine sounded different.
Yeah. Well, the fact that it sounds different makes me think it did suffer from being low on oil.
And what were those parts again you said that should be checked?
Well, checking, that's a really tough thing because now you're taking the engine apart. But the engine bearings... the condition of the cylinder walls. I think at this stage of the car's life, you may not want to go deep into the car like that.
It could be
quite costly.
Yeah.
It was suggested to me that the something called the valve lifters might be. Is that something that sounds like it would be hard to check?
They're not easy either. You know, this is not an easy thing you can just spend an hour on and say, yeah, this is what's going on, and you need to correct it.
Sure.
So,
yeah. Okay, my part two is real quick.
All right,
quick
real
easy.
Quick, Pat, because we're going to move
okay.
along.
My snow tires are dedicated on their own sets of rims. This winter, when I went and put my snow tires on the back of my car, they started rubbing against the struts. I had proper inflation. Now, I store my tires in the upright position, in the same orientation they would be in as if they were on a car. They're fully inflated. They have their own rims. Any idea why they would have suddenly started rubbing against the rim, why the tire would start rubbing against the
rim? Okay.
And these are the same wheels and tires that have always been on the car?
That's right.
Okay. If they are of the correct size, and now they're starting to rub, the car is starting to settle and things are slightly bending, and the orientation of the wheel to the strut has probably gotten tighter, and those snow tires may be a little bit on the large side, even though they might have the same correct numbers.
All right. Pat, we got to move it along, but thank you very much. Steve in Cummington. Steve, you're on.
Hey, Ray and Gordon, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
When I put gasoline in my car, immediately afterwards, it is very difficult to start. Once I can get it started, I could turn it off instantly then and restart it like a dream. But it's these very tense scenes in the gas station parking lot getting it going at the pump.
Hmm.
Now, Ray had a suggestion earlier because your call came up on our screen. He said, well, just don't put gas in it.
That's very economical, too.
Yeah,
I like it.
You'll save a lot of money.
What kind of car is it, Steve?
It's a Hyundai. It's a Elantra, and it's got about 70,000 miles on it, and it's, I think, a 2003.
Is your check engine light on?
No.
Okay. I experienced this on a car not too long ago. The check engine light was on, and it had a EVAP code having to do with the evaporative emission system. And this car had a stuck open vent solenoid. And the owner of the car said the strange thing about it is since the check engine light's been on, when I fill it up with gas, it starts real hard.
Hmm.
Yep.
And that valve being stuck open, when the tank filled up, it pushed a whole bunch of vapors into the intake manifold, and the engine was overburdened with vapors, and it acted as though it was flooded for a brief period of time. It took a lot longer, a lot of cranking to get it to start.
Interesting.
And it sucked all those vapors through, and then it started fine, and it never did it again. Make a long story short, we replaced that solenoid valve, and I said, you know, time will tell, but I think this might answer your starting problem, and it did. But the fact that your check engine light is not on, it still leads me to believe it's some type of a venting issue with the tank, but those can be tough to track down.
Okay.
But that's what I'd have to believe it is. It's pushing gas vapors in where it shouldn't when you fill that tank up.
All right.
Is it illegal to leave your car running while you gas up? I mean, that's another option, right?
Well, they all say turn it off.
Okay. Yeah. I must confess I've actually
listened. Unless it's 10 below zero.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Steve, we got to take a break. Thanks a lot. We'll get back to your phone calls. We'll check the social media, all of that coming up on Vox Pop.
Support comes from Hudson Valley Bounty, an initiative of the Hudson Valley Agribusiness Development Corporation, promoting Hudson Valley farms, wineries, restaurants, and more. HudsonValleyBounty.com. Identity Eyewear, Albany. Customized eyewear fittings, European frame lines, and more. Identity Eyewear, it's what sets you apart. EYEDENTITY Eyewear.net. And Bard Center for Environmental Policy, offering two continuing education and two-week short courses this month on land trusts and agriculture, and another on energy and environment in Asia. Bard.edu/CEP for registration.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551, the number, or you can hit our Vox Pop page at wamc.org/VoxPop, or you can go to our Facebook at facebook.com/WAMC Radio, or you could tweet us at WAMC Vox Pop. Yes, it's an endless list. And here, by the way, is Patrick Donges, our producer, with a little bit from the social media.
Hi, Ray.
Hello.
So Patrick, spelled with a D, by the way, on WAMC.org, asks, I went to change the struts on my Camry. That's a fourth generation 2000 Camry. But the bolts connecting to the rear axle carrier are rusted on. I aim to have my mechanic loosen them for me, but the mechanic wants me to get replacement bolts just in case the bolt heads snap off. It's a dealer part, so I called the dealer, and they said my car could have bolts of thickness variably at 17 millimeters, 15 millimeters, 15.5, and 14 millimeters. The new quick struts are SRT brand by Federated Auto, wondering if bolt size would be an issue. I contacted SRT, and they said they know about varying bolt sizes, saying that nobody has ever had a bolt sizing issue. The bolt holes are only 15.25 millimeters, which means only the 15-millimeter bolt size would be ideal.
Will there be a test after this?
There will be.
All right, Gordon, what do you think?
I think that probably when the Toyota dealer looked them up, they may have not sorted through all the information regarding options or whatever or other Camrys. And probably the strut maker is correct because the holes in the struts that these bolts are going to go through are going to be the same size as the what's holding the strut in the car.
Yeah.
So other than first taking it to the shop and getting a measurement to be sure, I think I would get the 15-millimeter bolts that, what was it, Federal Mogul?
Federal Auto Parts.
Federal Auto had recommended.
All right.
But yes, you definitely want to have those bolts on hand because they will more than likely break off.
All right. And now on to the quiz portion. A Camry. No, I'm not. Okay.
Patrick Donges, our producer. Patrick, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Ray.
Run on in here if you get something else over the wire. Charlie in Hoosick Falls, you're on.
Hello. Good afternoon, Gordon and Ray.
Hello.
I drive a mid-sized pickup truck with 149,000 miles on it. The tires currently have 26,000 miles on them, and I recently noticed that I'm getting excessive wear on the inside front edge of the front left front tire. My question or my concern is that, is there any way that lower ball joints might be involved, tie rod ends? I suspect the upper ball joints were replaced in a recall at 56,000. The tires were last rotated 6,000 miles ago.
Charlie, are you driving this truck in a severely abusive manner?
No.
I'm just kidding. I know Charlie.
When it said
Charlie in Hoosick Falls, I said, okay, I guarantee you. I'm going to know.
All right,
who this
so you
is.
Have some questions about yeah. the way Charlie drives.
No, I'm just kidding. He
All
knows
right.
that. No, if you get inside tire wear on one tire only, particularly in the front, yes, all the suspension components need to be carefully checked. Lower ball joints, upper ball joints, bushings that hold the control arms in. If
okay.
all of those things are fine and there's no wear, then, of course, it's going to be more than likely an alignment issue.
Hmm.
And that's the tilt of the wheel.
Right.
And camber in particular, the top of the tire, if it's tilted in way too far, that's too much negative camber. If the top of the tire is tilted way out, it's too much positive. So in your case, Charlie, if it's inside wear, it could be too much negative camber. So the question is something worn out? And if it is, that needs to be replaced first, and then an alignment has to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, it's very unlikely that it's the result of a tire itself.
Okay.
I think that's the direction that would go.
All right. Well, Charlie,
okay.
thanks a lot.
And one other quick addition to that, is
okay.
there any way to salvage that tire that's shown excessive wear by rotating the tires?
Yeah, you could definitely extend its life by simply putting it to the rear, because
okay.
the rear axle on your truck is non-adjustable, and it's pretty much true and straight. So those tires are going to stand up straight. You'll get the last life out of them.
All right, fair enough. Charlie, thanks
Sounds
a lot for
great.
The call.
Thank you.
Bye. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Gordon Fricke is our guest. We talk automotive issues today. Susan in Schenectady is on. Susan.
Oh, hello. Hi. Thanks for doing the show.
Sure.
My daughter has an old Toyota Corolla with less than 90,000 miles, and the handbrake is loose, and she has to have it inspected this month, and she would like to know if that's a minor adjustment or if that, could be a pricey repair.
Well, yeah, it could be both, but what gets commonly overlooked on handbrakes, particularly on cars with drum brakes, which I believe this one does. What year is it again?
It's a 90.
Yeah, definitely has drum brakes in the back. The adjustment of the rear brakes sometimes doesn't keep up the way it should, either by rust or the rear brake shoes could be at the end of their life, and the system can't adjust them out any further. But sometimes it's as easy as getting the rear brakes adjusted properly, and then your handbrake comes back all by itself because the handbrake is operating the rear brakes on that car. A lot of people, there's a misconception that you need to shorten the cable, but usually it's an adjustment of the brakes that has to happen, and that has to happen first. Then you go look at the cables and all the other stuff.
Okay.
So that's where I'd go with it.
Oh, I see. First the brakes, then you look at the cable.
Yeah, yeah. See if it's just a out of adjustment condition, and they may be able to get adjusted back up, and not a big deal.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Susan, thanks a lot. 1-800-348-2551, the number, 1-800-348-2551. Hartmouth in Great Barrington, you're on.
I drive an 87 Mercedes wagon, diesel 300 TD. And what happens sometimes and is when the transmission shifts, when I'm driving sort of from third into fourth gear, it's an automatic, the tail end kind of swerves. So it's like a hard shift, and it's sometimes pretty severe that, you know, the tail end shifts. Where does that come from? I had bushings changed in the back to, you know, tighten up the back, and now I'm running out of ideas.
Hmm. Well, that's what I was going to suggest, because Mercedes's of that vintage, I think they did have some bushing issues back there that would allow the rear axle to, or one of the rear wheels to shift, and that would make the car change direction. Is the only way you can simulate that is by accelerating relatively hard? That's when you feel this?
No, not when I accelerate, when it actually shifts up, not downshifting into a lower gear, but shifting up into the higher gear.
Right, but you're under pretty good power. You're looking to accelerate fairly hard when this happens?
Not necessarily. Sometimes I try to, the transmission tends to shift a little hard, so I try when I come to a certain RPM, I try to let off the gas pedal, to shift, to manipulate the shifting basically a mm-hmm. little. And then I can avoid that, but when I accelerate harder and it shifts by itself, basically it decides to shift, and it does that often.
Yeah. I think, when was the last time you had that rear suspension thoroughly checked?
The suspension itself checked?
Yeah, in the rear.
It was basically the same time the bushings were checked. I brought it to a mechanic and said, you know, that this is happening, and checked the bushing, the suspension. I mean, it has the hydraulic, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it has a hydraulic suspension that with a tank and a pump actually in the front, and it's a self-leveling, it's called a self-leveling system.
Yep. Yeah, I don't think that has any effect on that yaw
right.
or that shifting of the vehicle, you know, causing it to swerve a little bit. I think I would get that car back in the shop and really check everything that holds the wheels and axles on the car. You may find a strange worn out part somewhere that's eluding everybody.
Right.
But that's what I would think it's going on, because that's the only thing that's going to make you, the car going to change direction on an upshift.
Yeah.
Right. That's what I thought too. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling. Vox Pop is the program. Gordon Fricke is our guest. The phone number to call, 1-800-348-2551. It's Brian in Southfield's turn. Hi, Brian, you're on.
Oh, thanks. 45, almost 50 years ago, I used to be an instructor with the British military for various vehicles. And after hearing the question about the transmission, I thought that maybe the listeners would like to hear the definition that we use.
Great.
And it says, to supply a gear reduction that enables the engine to maintain constant revolutions under varying conditions of road and load, fed to the differential that supplies a final gear reduction and transfers power through 90 degrees from the engine to the wheels.
Uh-huh. Perfect.
That's excellent.
Does that make sense?
Well, yes.
It does to Gordon.
It does, but it's a little bit dated, because I think that was written when everything was, the engine was mounted longitudinally and the axle was across the vehicle. But now when you have transverse mounted engines, that power doesn't have to turn that 90 degree angle anymore. Much more efficient. But
uh-huh.
The
differential is in the transmission with front wheel drive vehicles,
yes.
But you still need a differential
yes.
in rear wheel drive engines, as in most pickup trucks.
Correct. Okay. Yeah. No, that applies for everything that is not transverse engine front-wheel drive. You're absolutely correct.
Hey, Brian, thanks for bringing that to the table. We appreciate it. So how does the Wankel rotary engine fit into this?
Well,
I just like to say that.
Yeah,
Wankel rotary.
They're pretty much extinct, okay. But Mazda kept them alive for a long time.
All right, fair enough. Susie in Sheffield. Susie, you're on.
Hi. I just had a question about transmission fluid. My garage, I have a 2002 Honda Accord, and anytime I bring my car in for work, the garage says I should change the transmission fluid. And I was raised never to touch that unless there was an issue. And I just wondered what you thought.
Yep. Very good question. And your car has a slightly different twist on an automatic. It's called a Honda-matic.
Ah.
And it isn't quite the same as a conventional automatic that you're thinking of. And there is a bit of, I don't know if I'd call it wives' tale or not, but there's a lot of thought about if you never change your transmission fluid and too much time passes, if you then change it, you're in for big trouble.
Ah, yeah,
and
you
it's,
heard that.
And it's possible. It does happen. In the case of your Honda, it's a little bit different of a transmission. And Honda recommends changing that fluid at certain intervals.
Mm-hmm.
And it's real easy to do. It's drain and refill. There's no pan to slop all over the place, and there's no little screen or filter in there. And there's not a real flushing procedure that a lot of shops do now. It's a real simple drain and refill. And if you do it all the time when they recommend it, you've always got nice, clean fluid in there. And you could really avoid a lot of trouble and get tremendous use out of that car.
Oh, good.
So the answer is yes. You should. And when you do a drain and refill, even if the fluid has gotten slightly darkened, you're not taking all of it out and putting fresh fluid in. You're taking 3 or 4 quarts out at a time.
Yeah.
So I think it's a good idea.
All right, good.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Susie, thanks a lot. 1-800-348-2551. Christian in Petersburg, New York, is on with Gordon Fricke. You're on.
Yes, thank you. My question is, can you tune in a wonderful growl on a car engine? And the reason I'm asking this question is that I had it with my 1994 Honda Accord 2.2-liter engine, not the VTEC, just the 2.2. It came with this wonderful growl, and now I own a 2006 Honda Accord with a 2.4-liter engine. I think it's got the VTEC on it. It doesn't have the growl.
When you say growl, are you talking about exhaust noise or no?
Absolutely not. I don't like fart machines on the back of cars. This is in the engine, caused by something in the engine. The RPMs, I think it would kick in at 4,000 RPMs and up. But it would kick in right around 4,000 and grow real sweet at 4,100 RPMs up and up. And if you want to know what I'm talking about, if you got the movie, the film, The Bourne Identity.
Yeah, great film.
Okay. You got that one? Yes.
Well, I don't know if I don't have it, but I've seen it.
Okay.
I've seen the films, yeah.
Okay, so in about the last seven minutes of the film, Owen Clive, the actor, is driving a BMW up or down the streets of Paris, France, and they capture the growl that I had with the BMW. It was the same exact growl.
Oh,
I think BMW must have it in their engines, even though they're 6-cylinder engines, usually, you know, that one was.
All right, what can you do to increase the growl?
Well, here's the thing. 4-cylinder engines have an inherent noise that's literally called booming, and if it's a 4-cylinder inline engine without any balance shafts, which Hondas have, they
correct.
Have a particular boom that occurs at about that RPM, and the most car manufacturers felt that was a condition that the customers were not interested in having, so they put balance shafts in them to totally smooth out and get rid of that booming sound. So you need to get a 4-cylinder engine that does not have any balance shafts built in, and you'll have that booming sound or growl.
Can he just take the balance shafts off?
No, but maybe you could buy a soundtrack for the For the CD player that has that car that Jason Bourne was chasing on that film, and just play it at certain times.
Now you're thinking outside the box.
Wait a minute. I don't want to get this mixed up. It was Clive Owen, the CIA assassin, driving the
right,
car.
But right. Where was Jason? Bourne. Where was Bourne at this time?
Well, he had already dealt with the CIA guy who came out who wanted to kill him.
He was having his Honda Matic worked on.
There you go. Yeah.
Hey,
no,
but let me ask one thing. The counter rotation balance. The balance shaft is on my Honda.
On your old one?
Oh yeah.
It was probably a few teeth off.
No.
I'm serious.
Wait a minute. I don't want to let you go on this. I have driven other 94, the same car, 94 through 97. That was basically the same engine, and with a VTEC on it. Driven them all, and they all have the growl. Yeah. Every one of them has the growl.
Yeah, I think
they tuned it out somehow. I don't know how they did it. Yes. But they tuned it out.
Interesting.
You're right, and I'm sure it is inherent to the design, but I don't think you can get it to happen on your new car, really.
Wow.
That's a shame. That's a shame, because the growl is just so wonderful. Engine can have beauty, and it can be music, and this car had music. Okay, take care, you guys.
Hey, Christian, thanks a lot for the call. Perfect spot for a break. Rawr! Zach, take it away.
Hey, that's that Honda engine.
There you go.
Support comes from Carrie Haddad Gallery, presenting sculpture by Amy Podmore, Roger Phillips, Stephen Walling, Linda Cross, Joseph Mariska, and Birgit Blythe through January 20th. CarrieHaddadGallery.com. Snow Farm, Williamsburg, Massachusetts, a New England craft program offering workshops for adults and teens taught by master craftspeople on a 50-acre farm. Snowfarm.org. And Dr. Johanning, Capital District and New York City, specializing in occupational and environmental health and prevention, including back disorders, water contamination, new technology, and mold problems. JohanningMD.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Gordon Fricke is our guest. Our producer, Patrick Donges, is here, a guy who knows a thing or two about Honda-matic transmissions. Patrick, what do you got for us?
Well, on Facebook.com/WAMC Radio, Freddie checked in and said, just got rid of my 2001 Accord, looking at a 1998 Nissan Maxima 5-speed. It's older than the Honda, but very powerful and smooth to drive. Is the Maxima a good car?
Ah.
Yes, the Maxima is a good car. Maybe a hair bigger than the Accord. And that Maxima, I'm certain, is a V6 engine, which the Accord may have been a 4-cylinder. And it's nice to get that with a 5-speed manual because, as we spoke earlier, an older, higher-mileage car, your fear is having a transmission problem.
Yeah.
And in that case, I would say that might not be a bad idea if he likes the car and if it's in great shape.
All right.
All right. That's it?
Yeah. Thanks, Gordon.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Patrick Donges. Back to the phones we go. It's Will's turn in Kingston. Will, you're on.
Hey, how you guys doing today?
Good. How are you?
Good. I was hoping you'd be able to help me. I have a 2008 Subaru Outback, and we just changed the catalytic converter in it, and it still drives like it has a bad catalytic converter. Poor gas mileage, no horsepower, and on.
Okay, what led you to replace the converter? I mean, did you do some testing? Did a shop say you had a plugged converter?
At first, we noticed that the gas mileage was starting to go down just a little bit, and then we started losing power, and it was shifting later. So we asked, I had to get a wheel bearing replaced, and we asked them to just look at that and see what it was. They plugged it in and said it was a catalytic converter. So we went to Subaru because it was still covered under the warranty. They diagnosed it again there. And replaced it, and as soon as we got in and drove, it had no power, and you know the gas mileage is still very poor.
Okay. Now the reason for replacing the converter then seems to me that you had a check engine light on, and it was probably a code PO420 for catalytic converter efficiency.
Yes.
Yeah. When that occurs, the cats usually almost are not plugging. They're just losing their ability to clean the air to the federal standards. If the converter happened to be getting plugged, you would have gotten a bonus by getting the exhaust system to breathe freely again. But I think you've got other issues. Now, when you took it to the dealer for that catalytic converter, did you ask them about the low power concern, or did you just say, I just want to get this converter changed because it's under warranty?
We just asked them for the catalytic converter because the previous shop that had done the wheel bearing had diagnosed it as the catalytic converter.
Yeah, and that PL420 code goes, that's very common. So that all that was fine, and you got a great thing by getting a new catalytic converter in there. As for the low power, it's going to have to be diagnosed. Go back to the original shop and, you know, say, look, we got the converters changed under warranty, but I still have the low power and late shifting. And just going to have to diagnose other issues. Mass airflow sensor is something to be thinking about. It's not likely, but once in a great while, you can have a muffler, the baffles in the muffler get mixed up in there, and you could have a restriction after the converter. It's not likely, but it's possible.
Oh, interesting.
So you're going to have to go back to the drawing board with the shop and just do some more diagnostics now that the converters are new.
All right. Will, thanks a lot. Now, so this is more than likely a sensor or something. I mean, would a computer reset possibly fix something like that?
No, because today's cars are constantly self-checking, and some of them are learning and they're adapting. So clearing things out really doesn't, in this case, wouldn't do any good.
All right. Colleen in Ellenville. Colleen, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Hi, Gordon. Sorry, I'm just turning my radio down. I'm calling because I've got a 98 Ford pickup truck, four-cylinder. And I don't run it all the time. And I tried to run it the other day. And it started up. I ran it up and down my road, but it was felt like it was choking, like it was gasping for air. So I came back, turned it off, looked underneath the hood, and the mice had made a nest and shredded the entire air filter.
Oh,
and this
boy.
Air filter, it doesn't sit right on top of the engine. It's one of those that's kind of off to the left and in the front over one of the headlights.
Yep.
So it's a big square air filter. And so I called my mechanic. He came up and looked at it, and then it wouldn't run. So he towed it down to the garage. He's had it there for a while now, and he says he can't figure it out what to do, but it's not starting up and it's not running. And I just don't know if I, you know, choked it up by running it, and maybe some of that air filter got into the engine somehow, or
well, did
not
the,
really.
Did the mice go right through the air filter? I mean, was sometimes
yeah.
they'll gnaw the edges that they can get to, but it doesn't actually go through to the other side. But they really destroyed it.
They really did destroy
yeah.
it.
Well, I mean, it definitely probably sucked some of the debris in. And not necessarily is going to hurt the engine, but what year is that truck?
It's a 98.
I'm not sure if a 98 has what's called a mass airflow sensor, but that mm-hmm. is an electronic device that measures the amount of air that the engine's looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And that is in the airstream after the air filter. It wants to be reading clean air. If by chance that thing is all plugged up, you could have running problems, but generally it won't cause the car to fail to start. So I think it's just going to require some basic diagnostics. You know, does it
mm-hmm.
still have adequate spark?
Yeah.
Did the timing not jump? It's a four-cylinder Ranger, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. That has a timing belt. There's a lot of things that I think the basics need to be first checked.
Mm-hmm.
Still be suspicious of the mouse problem, but make sure that all the basics are there first.
Okay. Could they have chewed a wire? Or
well,
something?
That's the other thing. You're absolutely right. They could have because they will chew wires, and they'll chew them in spots that you can't really see very easily.
But you get a code for that, wouldn't
well,
you?
Well, you generally would, and on her truck it would, being a 98.
All right.
Right.
Well, Colleen,
right.
call us next month and let us know how you did, okay?
Absolutely. I'll let you know if my mechanic just doesn't want to work on it.
Well, there's always that. Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Peter in Salem. Peter.
Yeah, hi, Gordon. I've got a question about my brakes. I've got a 2005 Dodge Ram 1500, and when I step on the brakes, I get a squeal from the right front. It doesn't squeal all the time, just when the vehicle is slowing from about 25 down about 15, and there's light pressure on the brakes.
And is this consistent, or is this just a once-in-a-while squeaking?
It's once-in-a-while. It tends to happen more if the wheels, if I've got tires turned at all.
Mm-hmm. Has anybody checked the condition of the brakes just to make sure they're wearing evenly and there's no problems with the anti-rattle clips or anything like that in there?
Not for a couple of months. It was past a second 2 months ago.
Okay. This is what I'd be looking for. Sometimes we'll find that the brake pads start to get stuck in their mounts, and it can happen on one side, not the other. And now you got a brake that's dragging because it's not fully releasing when you take your foot off the pedal.
Right.
And getting hotter. If it's only affecting one side, I'd be suspicious of possibly a sticking brake and or the hardware that holds them in if a piece of that is not where it should be.
Okay.
And brakes can squeak periodically just due to the mix of the material that makes up the linings. You get a hard spot, and then all of a sudden it goes away, and the squeak.
Yeah.
They were squeaking last month. Now they're fine. But I think it'd be wise to get it checked out to make sure you don't have a problem developing there, you know?
Okay. I'll take it in. I'll take a look at it then. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. Peter, thanks a lot. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Vox Pop is the program. Gordon Fricke is the guest. We've got Alex in Cooperstown. Hi, Alex.
Hi, gentlemen. I have a forensic question about a BMW.
Love this.
So I had a 2007 BMW 3 Series that I bought as a present to myself when I got out of the Army. And about 65,000 miles, I went to get my oil changed. And a couple hundred miles later, the brakes went out, and I took it to a dealer. I got the oil changed at a dealer. I took it to another dealer who said, well, we're sorry, you know, after a lot of analysis, we're sorry, but you need a new engine. And we think the first dealer must have messed something up when they changed your oil. And, you know, of course, as I pursued that, they backed off that story when the original dealer thought to be on the hook for the gigantic bill for a new engine. So I'm just trying to figure out exactly what went wrong.
Can you tell me what the cause of the engine failure is or was? What did they say went wrong? Did it seize?
There were metal shavings in the oil when they kept changing the oil.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I brought it for a second opinion to a private auto mechanic, and they thought that maybe a bolt had snapped off or something.
I mean, BMWs have incredibly good and durable engines. I mean, this BMW started out as an engine manufacturer. They made airplane engines.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they got their start. But so anyway, they take pride in making very good engines, but sometimes their oil change intervals are a little bit too long, in my opinion. Some of these new cars, the BMWs, will say no need for an oil change for 15,000 miles or 1 year.
And
you know, the fine print of that whole thing is those are ideal conditions, short stop driving, idling, winter seasons, all that has an effect on it. And they're saying, you know, speak to an expert or your dealer on oil change intervals if they don't fall into the perfect mode.
Right.
Problem is people buy these cars new, go to the dealer for the free maintenances, which occur not often enough. Then the next owner gets the car. He suffers from the lack of maintenance that was performed in the car's earlier life.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but on that point, you know, where we were previously, when we would bring it in for the free maintenance to the dealer, they would turn us away and say it's not time yet. That happened several times.
Hmm. Yeah, well, not time at BMW's expense. You could certainly have said, I'd like to cut these all in half and I'll pay for, you know, the ones that you don't cover. I have a lot of people that do that.
Bring
a car every other time, you know, you cut all the intervals in half. I'm not saying that's what happened to your engine, but I do see that on cars that have extremely long maintenance intervals. When they get older, that's when the suffering occurs. And other than somebody saying, you know, something, this XYZ went wrong in your engine, the oil pump failed or something like that, My only answer would be previous maintenance history, and or if it ever got so low on oil that it turned on the oil light and was driven for a bit, and that will definitely shorten any engine's life.
All right. Well, Alex, thanks a lot for the call. So metal shavings in the oil, it's not like the oil changes were they were using recycled oil, was it?
No, and BMW's been on synthetic oil since, I think, 1998.
Yeah.
And if you didn't use synthetic one time, it wouldn't destroy the engine, but they want those synthetic capabilities, and a lot of it's for those extended intervals.
Yeah. Let's go to Audrey in Pine Hill. Audrey, you're on.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hello.
I have a 2002 Dodge Durango, and I had some problems with it squealing. They had the belt checked, and it was not the belt. I took it to a local garage, and he looked at it, pulled the plug, and said, there, it won't do it anymore. And it's still doing it.
Do you know what plug he pulled?
I do believe it was from the compressor.
Oh, okay. Yep. So he disabled the AC compressor. But now does the squeal go away when they put a new belt on it and then it comes back after a while? Have you had a new belt put on?
Yes, I did.
And did the situation go away for a while?
No, it did not. That's why I took it to the garage, and he unplugged the compressor.
But that didn't change anything?
No.
Okay. Well, what needs to happen is the belt has to come off, and all the pulleys have to be very carefully checked for any binding or misalignment. If there's a crooked pulley, something went astray with a bearing or a mount, and one of those belt pulleys is crooked, it'll squeal all the time. Really, the alignment of all the pulleys have to be pretty good, close to perfect. Condition of the belt, of course, and sometimes you can get a belt that's made improperly and it will squeal right away. But that's what's going on. You got to just check all the stuff that belt runs over.
Okay. Audrey, thanks a lot.
All right, gentlemen. Thank you very much.
You bet. Let's go over to Lawrence in Valencia. Lawrence.
Oh, good afternoon, gentlemen. Enjoying the show.
Thank you.
I have a 2000 Passat that the cabin flooded from the sunroof. I was able to drain the water, fix the leak, and I have a bunch of error messages showing up, check engine light. An emissions workshop message comes up on the panel. I'm wondering what I'm looking at as far as possibly changing out the module as far as cost and
et cetera. Volkswagen did something that's really not very intelligent for a car maker of their caliber.
Yeah.
They put a computer module on the floor of that car.
Oh, brilliant.
And it is basically under the driver's feet.
Okay.
It really couldn't be much lower. You might as well put it outside.
Couldn't have been in a worse spot.
Yeah. And to complicate that, the sunroof drains plugged up a lot. And the water would come through the sunroof, and it's made to drain out the pillars, but that wouldn't happen, so it would flood the floor and literally put a couple inches of water in the car. So this computer is called the Comfort Module.
Okay.
And if you pick up the floor, the carpeting in front of the driver's seat, that's where it is. It's in a little case that is far from waterproof.
Yes, that's where I found it and was able to. I drilled a couple of holes in the floor to drain the water.
Yep.
Basically, tried to dry out the module itself.
Well, the module may have ruined because of the water, but you got it. That big giant clump of wires that goes to the module.
Yes.
Follow that forward, and it's going to go up to the left where the driver's left feet are, and it's going to go up into that little kick panel.
Okay.
And you need to take that harness apart and very carefully look, because you're going to find some green corroded wires and some factory splices that aren't factory splices anymore from all the leaks that sunroof has provided that wiring harness with.
All right. Now, guys, I'm sorry to say we're out of time. I hope that helps you, Lawrence.
Helps a little bit.
All right,
pretty much what I've already found out. Thank you very much.
I appreciate it very much. And thanks to everybody who called in today. Sorry if you didn't make it through. We'll get you next time, hopefully. Thanks to Occurring Compliance Services, LLC, Greenwich, New York, providing legal and consulting services to life insurers in a changing regulatory climate. CurrentCompliance.com. Empire Exhibits and Displays, Albany, New York. Custom exhibits, interactive displays on commercial casework for trade shows, events, museums, and corporate interiors. EmpireExhibits.com. And Boyden & Perron, Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repair services at a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years. BoydenAndPerron.com. Thanks to Zach Malloy at the controls, Sally Mars for answering the phones, our producer Patrick Donges. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's Moyers and Company. Next week on Medical Monday, rheumatology with Dr. Martin Farber. Thanks again to Gordon Fricke. Gordon, we'll see you next month.
Yes.
Your mic's off, but we will see you next month. Time for the news.